KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School as I record this show in late May. By the time you hear the show, I will be a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School and an assistant professor at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Today I'm very excited to have on the author of the book Ambient Findability, Peter Morville. Ambient Findability is a book that in its title suggests an interesting angle on information, and indeed it's the question of how people get information from the various streams of knowledge that come at them by way of the internet and indeed of technology generally. Ambient findability itself is a term that I will allow its author, Peter Morville, to define in our discussion today. But in Peter's book, we take a very, very in-depth and broad view of the technologies that exist today with respect to getting information. And indeed, not only getting the information, but how that information is processed and what people do with that information, ultimately leading to the question of how designers can create finding engines, if you will. That's a term I'm going to make up, although I don't think it's probably a very good one. I'll let Peter tell me that there are much better terms for it. But ultimately, this book covers not only the history of information searching and information findability, but also the technology and indeed also a bit of how-to for designers and others looking at creating these technologies. Peter's book is published by O'Reilly Media, and one of the things we'll be talking about, because I was noting it in a previous discussion with him just before we started doing the show, which is that you have color graphics, which I think actually are quite helpful in the context of this book, and we'll discuss that a little bit with Peter in the interview. Peter is the president of Semantic Studios, an information architecture and findability consultancy. For over a decade, he's advised clients such as AT&T, IBM, Microsoft, Harvard Business School, Internet 2, Procter & Gamble, Vanguard, and Yahoo. He's the founding father of information architecture. He's co-authored the book Information Architecture for the World Wide Web. He's also on the faculty at the University of Michigan School of Information and on the advisory board of the Information Architecture Institute. His work has been featured in a number of business and other publications, including Business Week and the Wall Street Journal. The book Ambient Findability, I think, suggests where we need to go at the beginning with Peter when we come back from the short music break to really define the term and then get into some of the details of what we mean when we talk about that term. The subtitle of the book, What We Find Changes Who We Become, I think is where we're going to start off. So after a short music break where I try to play music that relates to finding information, we will continue and start, indeed, the discussion with Peter Morville, author of the book Ambient Findability on KZSU, Stanford. Hopefully I found on the other end of the phone Peter Morville. Peter, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Terrific. Peter, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture to discuss your work.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's jump right in. As I mentioned in the introduction, yours is a title which it requires some explanation, I think, to the non-initiated. So the title of the book, what it means, and why you wrote Ambient Findability.
Sure. So, you know, my academic background is in library and information science, and since about 1994, I've been helping to grow what's become known as the field of information architecture, which is very much about structuring and organizing websites and other interactive services so that users can achieve their goals and specifically so they can find what they're looking for. So findability has been, you know, part of what I've been doing if you sort of trace back my kind of roots from librarianship through information architecture. But several years ago, I partly started to feel a little trapped within the box of my profession, information architecture, and partly just got really interested in pursuing this thread of findability, which certainly is a part of information architecture, but really extends much further and wider than that profession. And so I decided I wanted to pursue this interest. Another sort of factor was, you know, the word usability has been a, you know, a tremendously successful word that, you know, really sort of took off along with the web in the 90s, and in my opinion has become a little too broad and overused. And so I wanted to kind of help elevate the word findability and kind of, you know, get people's attention focused a little differently in terms of thinking about what's important on the web and really beyond the web.
The phrase ambient findability, you define early on in the book, and I think before I even get into some general questions about the book, before we get into details, how do you define that term?
Sure. So, you know, we're sort of at this, we're approaching the crossroads of, you know, the internet as we know it today and what we might call ubiquitous computing and the world of sort of mobile computing and location awareness and, tags embedded in physical space and so forth. And, you know, what I see is that we're headed towards a world which I call ambient findability, a world in which we can find anyone or anything from anywhere at any time. And this is not necessarily a goal. There's an awful lot of you know, rather difficult privacy issues that we're already starting to bump into. And we'll never quite reach the destination because of all of the sort of ambiguity and subjectivity inherent in language and organization. It's impossible to make findability perfect. But at the same time, we're certainly headed in this general direction of ambient findability, and my book is an attempt to sort of point out some of the signposts along the way.
The topic itself and the title, as I mentioned in the introduction, suggests a wide range of information, that you discuss in the book from early wayfinding forward. And I'm curious to know logistically how difficult it was for you to trace this history.
You know, it's funny. It was easy and impossible at the same time. With respect to the latter, much of the interesting information I'd like to have is lost forever in prehistory. When you really want to kind of study the early evolution of human wayfinding, and you sort of think back to, when was it that the first person, scratched marks on the bark of a tree to sort of stand as a signpost. When did the first group of people start sketching out a map in the earth? Unfortunately, there was nobody with a video camera who could, capture that event and upload it to YouTube. So, much of what I wanted to know is really unknowable. Given that limit, the web is such an amazing tool in terms of being able to find everything that has been printed. And so for almost all of my research, I was able to order either new or used books via the web, get a hold of the sort of academic papers via databases. And, as I sort of recount in the last chapter of my book, there was a certain irony that the last paper I really wanted to find was the first one that actually forced me into an academic library to search through the stacks.
I am, even though I am focused professionally on technology and enjoy it and use it, my wife may think I use it too much, but I use it a lot. I am also one of these types who enjoys going through the stacks.
Uh-huh.
I was a student and still am, I think, in a lot of ways, the kind of person that will go into a library and for a specific purpose to find a certain thing and then stumble across something of equal interest to me and then wind up several hours later wondering what it is that I first came in
sure.
to find. And in that way, the ambient findability you're describing with respect to the internet is a very different experience than stumbling. Or is it? Which I guess is my lead-in question. How much of what we talk about today in findability is similar to what you describe and what I just described in the days, you know, not too long ago, and you can still do it, of course, in stumbling upon information by just going through stacks?
I actually think there's an awful lot of stumbling still going on in the internet environment, and in fact, I use that precise example, the traditional library experience, where we stumble upon interesting books on topics that we may not have even knew existed before, and then I kind of talk about the fact that, you know, in the online environment, we have all sorts of opportunities to recreate that associative learning experience, through the use of see also links. In a business setting, people think of, this in terms of cross-selling and upselling. If you're interested in this product, you might like these products. But, you know, from an educational perspective, we absolutely have the opportunity to create the sort of encyclopedia experience of hypertext jumping from one topic to another. And, you know, there are opportunities to design that consciously as part of the information architecture of a site. But there are also all sorts of interesting opportunities emerging in the world of tagging and folksonomies where, users are surfacing connections that maybe nobody thought of before.
You used a few terms there that I want to define shortly, but I think to set the context for the discussion, it would be useful to go to one of the points that you make early on in the book, which actually, you know what, I'm going to take a step back because there's one other logistical question I do want to ask you, which I think is interesting, which is your use of color graphics in the book. This is more of a logistical book issue, but again, being a book nerd in every sense, and in fact, I grew up in a home where both of my parents are in the publishing business, I tend to notice this stuff. Now, I'm not going to ask you about the paper stock and the glue. I'll skip that for another discussion. But I found it useful, and I'm curious to just, your rationale behind it, but you have many color graphics here, and they primarily show either particular web pages or designs or what have you. Your book, I think, can be appreciated by scholars as well as people that are looking for kind of how-to advice. But I'm curious to get your thoughts on how and why it is that you have these color graphics, which I personally enjoyed, but which you don't see that often in these books.
Sure. Well, unfortunately, the honest answer is that, you know, this is basically a part of serendipity, that O'Reilly, you know, as I was working on the book, O'Reilly kind of let me know that the costs of color printing had come down to a level at which, it was reasonable to do this book in color. I think that my editor had seen some of the images that I was sort of pulling in to the book and kind of recognized that there was a really interesting opportunity to kind of leverage the kind of color photos and diagrams to maybe provide a little bit better of a reader experience. But sort of more broadly, as I was writing this book, you know, I thought of it partly as a testament to the web and just the wonderful sort of mashup quality, to throw in another new word, of the web. And so this book actually has some similarities there in terms of the combination of academic citations and references, but a very kind of bloggy kind of, hopefully fairly readable prose, along with color images. And I really intended it in every sort of sense of the term to be a boundary spanner and to kind of cross all sorts of categories, the more the better.
I think it works well, especially for those that aren't familiar with the technology and would like to see it represented there so they can contextualize what you're discussing.
Sure.
With that background, as tempted as I am to get into the logistics of manufacturing a book, which I know far more about than the listeners need to know for purposes of hearsay culture, one of the core assertions that you make in the book early on page 15, you say that ambient findability revolutionizes, quote, how we define authority, allocate trust, and make decisions. So describe what you mean by that.
Well, what I see, and this is really mostly happening on the web right now, but I think it's indicative of larger trends in society. We increasingly have the opportunity to select our sources and choose our news, and we truly are living in a society of absolute information abundance. And I think that this is subtly changing the ways in which we learn and make decisions. You know, and I think back to when I was a little kid growing up, and I had a fairly old single-volume encyclopedia in my bedroom. And whenever I, got interested in a subject or wanted to know what something meant, my dad would say, why don't you go look it up in your encyclopedia? And there was this very comforting sense that, all the knowledge of the world was in that book and that it was all true. It was the authority. And, to sort of think about kids growing up today, there are so many different sources of opinion and different sets of facts even. And what I, on the one hand, this can be a scary phenomenon, and you see in the a lot of the debates about the Wikipedia and, whether that's a positive or negative influence on society, people can get very upset about this issue of the increasing number of sources of authority. And yet, personally, I see it as a really positive thing, but it does place more responsibility on the individual to figure out, who do I trust and why, and to what degree do I need to cross-reference or cross-check my facts when I'm exploring something that's important.
It's a topic of particular interest to me because that very idea is kind of what the impetus for naming my show Hearsay Culture. Now, if I was even more creative, maybe I would have named it Ambient Findability, and then we would have had some trademark and copyright issues to sort out. But I'm sure we would have resolved them amicably. But the idea of hearsay culture is the same thing, that hearsay in the law is information where its veracity is subject to dispute, and it requires a certain judgment on the part of the individual to decide whether that particular statement is worthy of credit. And in that way, I use the word culture to suggest where we are with respect to technology and information gathering. Ambient findability, as the title of the book suggests, that there are other phrases and words that you use in the book which are not in the vernacular of most people. And I think I should ask because some people have said that the book uses too many of these kinds of catchphrases, and in that way the book becomes less accessible or more subject to dispute. What's your response to that suggestion that your book and indeed this area uses too many of these new catchphrase type words and suggests that lack of connection?
Sure. Well, as far as the accusation goes, I'd say guilty as charged. I embrace new words or neologisms with enthusiasm. And I'm always sort of amused when I hear that complaint, and it's sort of heard in lots of different arenas, this sort of frustration with the evolving nature of vocabulary. I would say that new words and phrases kind of invite us and help us to see the world a little differently, to recategorize, to sort of understand a new phenomena or an innovation. And, you know, there's of course plenty of bad that goes with the good. There's hype, there's kind of confusion caused by, you know, silly words and phrases that don't necessarily live very long. But I do think that there's a tremendously important role that vocabulary plays in helping us understand the changes that are going on in technology and society. What's also funny is that very often when people complain about new words, they're actually old words that people haven't seen before. And, you know, we're living through an interesting period of time where, you know, large percentages of, you know, the vocabulary that are used in certain circles are not present in dictionaries. And yet you may get, you know, a few million hits on that word in Google. And you know, so we have a very visible way of seeing the evolution of our vocabulary over time.
It's I enjoy new words, and so I, you know, in reading a book like this, when I come across a word, I'm hoping, especially a term, I'm hoping that it's defined. But I think that your response leads to a follow-up, which is there are those that say that what technology is dealing with today are really not new issues at all, that they're simply a different medium for discussing the same problems that we've always had, and that therefore these new terms aren't necessary. Now, I can say, I don't think the listeners will be surprised to hear me say that I don't agree with that criticism, but I'm curious to, again, I mean, in light of the suggestion that what we're dealing with in technology today is nothing more than an expansion of the same issues we've always had with respect to culling and clarifying information, how you come down on that concern?
Sure. Well, let's take a word in particular. I'll take findability. Now that's a word that is not new. I certainly didn't coin the term, and I'm not sure who did. But the first time I remember seeing the word findability used was in the first edition of our information architecture book in 1998, and my co-author used the term, and I sort of hated it at first. It was a sort of ugly, kind of awkward word that was unfamiliar, and I wasn't sure what value it added. And, you know, then probably 4 or 5 years later, I kind of rediscovered the term, and for me, it sort of had presented some interesting potential to explore the convergence that's going on between wayfinding in the physical world and the ways that we import wayfinding behaviors into virtual environments. And, you know, the sort of concepts of information retrieval and search and navigation that have historically been kind of wedded to the digital world. And as we move forward, I see, you know, increasing convergence and ways in which wayfinding and retrieval are going to impact one another. If you imagine, you know, somebody who's sort of walking along with a location-aware device, and you know they're getting suggestions about restaurants to try, parks to visit. You know, walking becomes a form of querying, and that's not something we've seen in the past. And, you know, I think that findability kind of, you know, serves as an interesting bridge between disciplines that have been separated in the past. And, you know, what's sort of interesting to me is that, you know, back in 2001, when I really decided to start advocating the use of this term, there were only about 2,000 Google hits on findability. Hmm. And now you're getting nearly 2 million. And people are starting to sort of just use the word without thinking about it as a new word. And so for me, that was a success. And, you know, I think there's lots of these sort of language experiments that are going on, and some fail and some succeed. But they are helping us to better understand where we're headed.
I think in every, you know, generation, you have words that crop up that are scorned because simply because they're new and because there is language that exists that predecesses that word that, you know, if you put five words together, you would get the same thing as the new word. That's, you know, again, I guess I'm going in various directions with that issue, but, you know, I think this is a good time actually to take a short music break before we come back and discuss some of those catchphrases and how you discuss them. I also want to add, on the logistical thing, I was looking at the cover and it reminded me that I was reading the book, rereading the book yesterday, for purposes of thinking about good questions to ask, and I was reading a book with my 4-month-old son on a playmat below me, and suddenly he was staring at the book, and I realized on the cover you have a rare lemur found only in Madagascar. So I can say that the added bonus is that there was a findability issue right there, where my son, I think, saw his first real animal picture and was fixed on it. So again, the graphical nature of not only the findability environment, but indeed the book, I think, led to unintended consequences, which
sure.
is, I guess, what findability is all about anyway.
Right.
You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. We're chatting with Peter Morville, author of the book Ambient Findability. Before we return to the conversation on Hearsay Culture with Peter Morville, author of the book Ambient Findability, now is the time on the show where I ask you to find your wallet, or at least look for it, and make a donation to KZSU. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford that relies on donations from listeners to continue its programming. If you're interested in perhaps making a donation after you find your wallet, you have a couple of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do hope that you will continue to listen. So we're back with Peter Morville. And Peter, we were talking about the phrases in the book, and I think it's time now to discuss some of them and how they fit into ambient findability generally. One, let's start with one that you mentioned in the previous discussion, which is folksonomies. What does that mean, and how does that fit into the work that you're doing?
Well, folksonomies is a word that was actually first coined on an information architecture discussion list back in 2004. A couple of friends of mine, Thomas Vanderwall and Gene Smith, were talking about this phenomenon of user-contributed tagging, the sort of stuff that we've seen on Flickr and Delicious, and you know, wondering, you know, how can we describe the sorts of kind of bottom-up taxonomies, emergent organization schemes that could be, you know, created or could emerge through this activity of many users, you know, employing lots of different tags to describe similar objects. And so Thomas sort of came up with this notion of folksonomy, you know, building on the kind of folk word and kind of mapping it onto the back end of taxonomy. It's, you know, the most, it's funny because it's, that's a huge success story in terms of words. It's you'll now see just an amazing number of hits on that word. It's become a very popular word in the internet, and yet it's actually the actual phenomenon is actually fairly elusive. If you ask someone to point you to a folksonomy, it's not so easy. You know, we have this vague sense that, you know, a tag cloud provides some, you know, interesting visual view into you know, a set of tags. Flickr has had some real success with their clusters and the, you know, the interesting you know, sort of view into slightly different uses of a word depending on which other tags were kind of used along with that word to describe a photo. But folksonomy is almost more of a promise than a reality. It's this idea, you know, this kind of idea that order can emerge from the distributed chaos of many people tagging stuff.
Now, for listeners that aren't familiar with the term tagging, perhaps you could just define that term just for clarity purposes.
Sure. So, if we take the online photo sharing service Flickr, where anybody can upload their own digital photographs, in order to be able to retrieve those photographs to find a particular image among several hundred or thousand, then one of the most effective ways is to go ahead and tag that photograph to apply a keyword or phrase to each photograph. And in fact, people will apply several. And the innovation in Flickr that has really caused it to be such a big success is that while people are mostly tagging images for their own purposes so they can re-find what they've tagged, those tags are also shared with everybody. So all of a sudden you have this amazing kind of digital library of photographs with tags as the means of finding. And this has sort of caused almost a sort of a quasi-religious political movement in the sort of the digerati, because it's seen as a much better solution in certain contexts than the traditional approaches that come from librarianship and information architecture, where you have professional people describing, whether it's books or photographs or any sort of resource. And so there's an interesting kind of, ongoing debate and kind of pendulum swinging back and forth in terms of figuring out, what's better, taxonomies or folksonomies, amateur versus professional.
Right. That issue kind of leads me into another area that you discuss in the book, which is geocaching and tagging, and the issues of the intersection of physical and virtual worlds. Perhaps you could describe that intersection and how those two worlds intersect in your view.
Sure. So, first of all, we've got a really interesting sort of area opening up with global positioning systems and location awareness in general. And right now, a lot of what's going on, fits into the categories of play and experimentation. So, geocaching is a game that's been around for quite some time now, where people will hide a cache or some sort of treasure in a particular location, and they'll put clues out there about its precise coordinates, the longitude and latitude and altitude and so forth. And so then people, armed with their GPS devices, go out into the woods or the urban environment searching for this cache. Another example, it's a little newer, there's a company called Area Code that's based in New York City, and they've started producing what they call big games. And, in their words, what they're doing is sort of turning a city into a massive board game. And real people, sort of in physical space, essentially become avatars, and their locations are tracked on this board game by their companion players who are sitting at computers, and this game can be observed by anyone around the world. And so here's another example of experimenting with the idea that we can now take a representation of the physical world, we can overlay this precise location of individuals in that world, and we can start really playing with the boundaries between physical and digital.
This game Area Code, I guess, I'm going to ask kind of an open-ended question. What is the purpose of the game? Is it along the lines of the purposes for going into something like Second Life or there, or is there an actual goal or strategy, or there's some markers you have to achieve? How does this work?
Yeah. Well, right now they have designed several games that are variations on this theme, and the purpose overall is to draw attention to a particular issue or company. But one specific game that they created is called Pac-Manhattan, where Manhattan becomes the kind of the screen of from the Pac-Man, the old arcade game of Pac-Man,
mm-hmm.
and people who dress up in brightly colored outfits are the the Pac-Men and women, and sort of coordinating with via cell phone and wireless devices with people in front of computers. Their job is to run around Manhattan and try to eat up the virtual fruits and vegetables or what have you.
So is it literally? Maybe I'll go into a level of detail that with which you're not familiar. But is it like a treasure hunt kind of thing where you're finding stuff and trying to avoid others? You're told make a left on 43rd Street or something like that, and you move around that way.
Sure, absolutely.
Is this indicative, in your view, of where we're headed in terms of findability, that the technology is going to encourage more and more of this intertwining of the virtual and the physical? Or because up to now, I think more, people have viewed them, especially the Second Life and their kind of communities as some alternate universe. For those that are actually in it, of course, it's very different. But viewed from the outside, it's literally a second world. Do you see more intertwining occurring as the technology advances?
Yeah, I think everybody's sort of asking the question. Okay, we're surviving through the period that's called Web 2.0, and what is Web 3.0? And there's a lot of things that might sort of happen in the near term, but I personally think that the very interesting thing that's going to be happening over the slightly longer term, we're talking not necessarily within 5 years, but sort of 10 to 20 years, is what's been called the Internet of Objects or the Internet of Things. And it's really kind of moving the Internet beyond searching through digital files and embedding bits and pieces of the Internet in the physical world. It's things like, it's interesting because right now we're in an era of games and experimentation, and there's a lot of things like Second Life that are very interesting in one respect, but most of us after trying it just can't really figure out why would I invest so much time in this new environment. It's kind of complicated, and I don't totally understand the practical value.
Right.
And so you've only got early adopters right now, but something big is going to come out of that. I think Second Life is the beginning of something big, but it's not there yet, and it takes a lot of work to explore. An interesting kind of product in the business world, Cisco has a wireless location device, and within a wireless network area, you can use radio frequency ID tags to tag and track high value objects. So one place where there's already been a strong return on investment shown has been in hospitals, where apparently they're always losing their wheelchairs.
Hmm.
And it's not that they're stolen, but they're placed in a closet or left, people forget which room that wheelchair was left in, and they spend a tremendous amount of staff time searching for wheelchairs.
Hmm.
So by tagging and tracking wheelchairs, hospitals have been seeing really significant, returns on investment. They're saving a lot of staff time. They're getting patients, into their wheelchairs and out the doors more quickly and efficiently. And that's an application that it's worth thinking in lots of different business contexts. What's the return from tagging and tracking high value objects?
The tagging and tracking, of course, is one of the issues that scares a lot of people. And certainly the privacy advocates and people concerned about privacy, and I'm one of them, wonder about this. When we talk about RFID tags and we talk about wearable computing, the idea of computers that are physically on the body, we raise these issues. What's your reaction to those that are concerned about privacy and the cliche Big Brother type situation?
On the one hand, I'm really glad that we have people who are very concerned about the privacy issues, and with radio frequency ID chips, for instance. There's a website, I think, called spychips.com or .org, where there's a couple of real activists who are kind of forcing people to confront some of the scary potential of the technology. At the same time, I think that there's some, tremendously fascinating and potentially really productive uses that we haven't even begun to explore yet. And so, I think we have to have the debate about the privacy and the health implications of embedding chips under your skin, for instance. And at the same time, it's one of these phenomena that is not going to stop. The train has left the station. There's progress happening in all sorts of different arenas. There are people who are literally hacking their own bodies to embed chips, and so we have another new term, body hacking.
Body hacking meaning installing devices into your body.
Right. It's basically taking the term hacking or hacker from the software domain, and now talking about body hacks. An older term would be human augmentation.
Right. Tattoos.
Right, absolutely. and in fact, I'm convinced that it's going to be the teenagers who pioneer a lot of this, just as they have, had their arms tattooed and their, and had various pieces of jewelry embedded in their lips and navels. And we're going to see them embedding various sensors and chips in the not too distant future, as an act of rebellion and as an act of forging stronger ties with their peers.
At the same time, you point to a technology which exists today and which you can purchase that basically attaches a tracking device to your child, so that you could figure out where your child is in any given moment using the same technology generally that we use now in cars to map our routes. But you point out, which I think is an interesting concept, which is that we're not in the use of that technology where you put this device on the child's wrist and the child goes about their day. All you're finding out ultimately, at least at this stage of the game, is where they are, but you don't know what they're doing.
Exactly.
Logical question, which follows from that is, how far are we from knowing what they're doing? Not to get too pie in the sky or futuristic, but when we talk about the idea that games exist where, as you describe with area code, where people are becoming avatars, and you suggest that there's something big coming with respect to Second Life, how far away are we from really, to get back to the privacy issues, just having privacy become nothing more than something which is either enforced by law or doesn't exist at all?
That's a good question. I know you've had David Brin on the show in the past, and I'm a real fan of his book, The Transparent Society, in which he sort of advocates that privacy is history, that the rich and powerful already have the ability to track our every move, and the only question is, do we want to be able to watch the watchers, to really have a transparent society? And I really believe that we already live within a sphere of, where surveillance is almost ubiquitous without even realizing it. Several years back, when we had first moved into a new home, there was a murder just around the street at a Blockbuster video. And this was certainly very unsettling, having just moved into the neighborhood. They caught the person a week later, and it turned out that the surveillance camera from all the way across the street had picked up this person going into the store. And that kind of really got my attention, that it's amazing that how far these cameras and various sort of listening devices can operate. And they're all around us, and we barely notice them. And in fact, we may choose not to notice them because we prefer not to think about it. I think that from a technological perspective, we are going to have the capability to basically create a ubiquitous panopticon where our every move can be tracked and watched. So it's going to force us as a society to set new rules. We no longer have the common sense definition of privacy, where if I step into a room and close the door, I trust that nobody else can see or hear me. And so certainly, there's going to need to be new legislation as well as just a sense of etiquette in how we handle that.
Do you get the sense, and this is more of a sociological question, maybe a little bit far afield from where we are, but not so much. Do you get the sense that the designers, the people that are putting this technology together, are concerned with those issues? There's always a desire to build something better, build something greater, and in any science, or indeed in any area, there's a conflict between, okay, once we build this, what are the ramifications? And of course, the atom bomb or cloning. I mean, all of these issues come up, and scientists and technologists are forced to confront what the consequences will be of creating this technology. With respect to these particular technologies and the privacy concerns, what's your sense of the designers' awareness, A, and B, concern about these issues?
I think that designers are thinking about these issues to a certain degree. That doesn't mean that it stops them from moving ahead. I'm a big fan of Adam Greenfield, who wrote a book, came out just after Ambient Findability, called Everywhere.
And Adam will be on the show later in the year.
Okay, great. And so, he talks about the ethical implications of designing for ubiquitous computing, and he's a real activist in trying to raise awareness among designers about the sort of world that we're creating. On the other hand, what I find interesting is that users are heading in almost the opposite direction. If you look at some of the successful technologies of the last few years, users are really interested in sharing all sorts of intimate parts of their lives. Blogs are perhaps the beginning of that phenomenon, where people are taking what used to be a diary and making it public.
Mm-hmm.
We see YouTube and MySpace, people posting up all sorts of videos and photos, and to some degree changing their behavior as a result of becoming watched. I actually think that some of this is driven by technology and what's possible. Some of it's driven by this desire to kind of share various aspects of your life. And so there's a lot of demand from users for those kinds of solutions.
And I do think that certainly there's a kind of a bubble effect to some degree for people that focus on these issues, to be sure. And we see the willingness of the public generally to go along in large measure with other invasions of privacy that heretofore haven't been well received, but that's a topic, I suppose, for another day. In the last basically 2 minutes that we have, I have a question which is going to take more time, but I'll give it to you anyway, which is, we had Richard Lanham on the show earlier in the year, who's written about the book The Economics of Attention, and that there's an attention deficiency with regard to information. In your view, in the short amount of time, does findability address those concerns?
Yeah, and I've got kind of a practical and a philosophical answer. On the practical side, then, in a world where we truly have a poverty of attention, where every consumer or customer or user's attention is being pulled in many different directions, I think that, we need to shift some of the investment in the business world from push towards pull. Away from advertising and fighting for people's attention towards information architecture and search engine optimization and making sure that when our customer wants something, whether it's a product or some information, they can find it very quickly and easily. On the more philosophical note, as we head deeper and deeper into this world of continuous partial attention where people are twittering about what they did 2 minutes ago, I do think that we need to be a little concerned about what that's doing to the ways in which people learn and the ways in which we make decisions and look at, you know, to the degree to which our decision making may be getting worse as a result.
I guess the wrap up question, Peter, what has been a fascinating discussion, and I always run into this where just an hour just isn't enough. For those that want to learn more about these issues and your work, what do you recommend?
Well, I blog at findability.org, and so that's a good starting point to kind of find me and kind of get pointers to other publications and articles I've been working on.
Terrific. Peter, I do hope that I'll be able to have you on the show again in the fall where we can kind of pick up on some of these issues. So I invite you back. And I want to thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, discussing your book, Ambient Findability, What We Find Changes Who We Become. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
So I want to thank Peter Morville again for being on the show today, discussing his book, Ambient Findability. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show is being recorded in late May for airing over the summer as I prepare to teach in my new job at the Charlotte School of Law. In Charlotte, North Carolina, as a professor. So I am putting together shows in late May and early June to air over the summer. As always, you can find this show by podcast, for those of you not listening live on KZSU, by going to the internet page for Hearsay Culture at hearsayculture.com, or by going to CIS's page at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or finally on the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society through iTunes. You'll find the podcast there. For all schedule and previous shows and other information about the show, you should go to Hearsay Culture. As Peter mentioned, Adam Greenfield's book, Everywhere, Adam's going to be on in the fall, and I'm looking forward to not only the guests, which I've already scheduled, but a number of guests that I'm going to be scheduling over the next month or so for airing in September and October. So thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more of its programming and more discussion and more lively music, and I will look forward to talking to you next week.